Constructive Criticism is sponsored by Oasis Games. MTGOasis.com is the place to get cards for your next Magic event. Try them out with code CCMTG for 15% off of your first order, and use the code WouldThatBeGood for 4% off of every order. Want to support the show directly? Head on over to patreon.com/CCMTG to check out some awesome benefits and future goals for the show. Thanks for listening, and here's this week's episode of Constructive Criticism. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Constructive Criticism. I'm your host, Spencer, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Seth Manfield.
Hello.
And John Stern.
Hi, guys.
You know what's the best part is if you're watching the video, you got to see that John's name was under Seth's face, and Seth's face was under John's face. So they switched today.
All right, I'll just see guest, so I don't know.
How are you guys doing this week?
I'm doing good. Yeah. Getting into modern. It's fun.
Hopefully you sound better for the listeners.
Yeah. Do you like my new headset? There it is.
Ah, thanks, good, man.
It's snazzy. So this week we're talking about, we're going to do a deep dive on the Gruul Aggro deck, which is a deck that we kind of talked about on our last podcast, to be honest. The Pro Tour podcast, we had kind of talked about Tim Wu's deck we pitched it to our patrons what they wanted us to talk about. And this was the thing that they wanted. So we're going to take a deep dive on kind of that deck and our experiences with it and kind of our thoughts around that deck. Before we do that, though, let's get to our Patreon question. If you're a patron, at patreon.com/CCMTG, you can ask a question on the show. This week we have, how do you become a better deck builder? I want to be better at innovation, better at innovating archetypes and improving decks. I was wondering the steps to improve at these things. I think the period messed me up there, but it's just not a period. I'm just reading incorrectly. But yeah, let's talk about this really quick. This is something that I actually do a lot of personally. I think Seth, you feel the same. This is something that you try and take part in Magic. Some people, they don't take part in the deck building process, but you actually seem to really enjoy it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm willing to build my own decks. Like I'm not someone that is going to be necessarily, like, I like to have a basis, just a starting point, but I'm a creative thinker, and you have those personalities where they're willing to, you know, to do that. And so for sure, I'm not just gonna take a backseat in that regard.
One thing, I would say, in order to answer the question a little bit, is that it's really important to sort of understand the pillars of the format and sort of attack it. Like if you look at the deck that Seth played, the PT, for example, he identified Hostage Taker and Thief of Sanity as cards that are really well positioned, and he built a deck around that. I think when people try to build a deck, sometimes they're like, oh, this card's cool, I want to play with this card, and it might be a really good card, but it might not be well positioned in the format. A card, like, for example, if you look at Hero of Precinct 1, I think that's a great card, but it just matches up very poorly against Kai's Wrath or Find Finality or Nexus of Fate going over the top, and the decks that came out of that, I mean, they're okay. You can play the card, but maybe you're starting on the back foot if you do that, if you take that approach.
Yeah, one of the go ahead.
Yeah, I was just saying that's a great point. If you're able to, I like to think about, like, it's super hard when you're just starting out a new format, right? Where, like, Ravnica Allegiance pre-release or whatever weekend, you have no basis for what the metagame might actually be. Whereas once the metagame becomes more defined, you can specifically target decks and realize, okay, this card is good against this deck. And so I like to think about cards and then how to build around them. I also like to think about my sideboard. This is kind of a plug for something I just recently did, but I'm going to go ahead and say it. Because I just recently did a course for Spike's Academy on specifically sideboarding. And so I think building your sideboard is something that players don't necessarily approach correctly, or they don't necessarily think about enough. And so I like to kind of think about if it's best of three or best of one, it's very different, right? But obviously we don't need to, unless you're playing Masterminds Acquisition specifically, there's not really that much to think about. For best of one, but for best of three, which is most tabletop gamers, I'm assuming when watching this, are thinking about that, you know, definitely thinking about building a 75 card deck. Like, I'm willing to make my 60 a little bit worse and make some sacrifices if I think it's gonna like improve my games two and games three, and like I'm fine with just being 0% against control or whatever in game one. That's fine. So like, just kind of realizing how your matchups play out, I think, is important.
Yeah, I think you two covered kind of the big things that I think about. I qualified for my first Pro Tour with my very own brew. It's been a part of kind of what I do in Magic for forever. And I think that you both hit on really key points. You know, the first thing is like, identify cards you want to play with, and then then compare how those cards would line up against, like John said, those pillars of the format. And, you know, I think that for me, I gravitate towards certain things. I played Jeskai Control for months in Standard with Felidar Guardian and Heliri because I wanted to attack that as that combo deck as the control deck. And I think that kind of just understanding what you're trying to attack will really help you decide, you know, what cards do I want to play with from here. I think that's how the Gates deck, you know, became a thing, right? People were like, well, I really, really want to play with, explosive vegetation. But the weakness of this deck is that I need to be able to kill a lot of creatures at once because my deck's slow. And then they're like, well, if I play Gates, I can actually play Gates Ablaze. And that kind of stuff is how decks come together for a lot of people. It's not always going to work for you. You're going to build a lot of decks that are not very good. But it's kind of just about iterating and trying different things and kind of focusing on those two things. You know, what are the cards you want to play with what are the decks you're trying to beat?
And another thing you can do is kind of try to replicate known strategies like that are already, you know, are good, but try to like build on those concepts in a completely new deck. Like maybe you take, all right, I know I need a mix of removal and counter spells and maybe some planeswalkers or some card advantage in my mid-range deck. And so you kind of know, all right, like there's some placeholder slots, like you need some amount of win condition. So you kind of have this like template in your mind of how things start to work. Maybe it's an aggro deck where you have, all right, I need to have a certain curve of creatures, like so that I can actually just play something starting on turn one, starting here, starting there. So just having, and once you start to build decks, it just kind of forms. I just already have it in my mind where I'm just like, if I know I'm playing a mid-range deck, I need these things, or if I'm playing an aggressive deck, I need to have this type of curve and that type of thing.
I also like to when you come up, so you're trying out a deck that you innovated on or you're tuning or whatever, I like to test with like specific questions in mind. Like if I want to find out, you know, which, you know, we're going to talk about Gruul, so we'll get into it, but like which five drop I want to play, like I want to test the matchups where those differences are going to be highlighted, try to answer specific questions, and then sort of go back to the drawing board and come up with new questions and keep going like that and iterating rather than just trying to just build a 75 on paper and run with it.
Yeah. On that note, though, John, I think one of the mistakes a lot of people make is they'll iterate their deck and then they'll never go back to testing against the other decks after they've made those changes to like fix different matchups. And then they go and play this deck at a tournament and they're like, well, I thought this matchup was good for me, but I just got crushed. And it turns out they changed some, you know, very important cards in that matchup. Mm-hmm. But now the matchup's all of a sudden bad.
Sure. That can definitely happen.
Awesome. Do you guys have anything else on this question specifically?
I think we covered it pretty well.
Yeah. So thank you so much for that. If you want to ask those questions, just head over to patreon.com/ccmtg. There's a post every month where you can ask those questions there. So let's move on to our next segment, which is hashtag always improving. We want to kind of talk about things that we're doing to improve at Magic each week. You know, whether it's playing best of one, or whether it's preparing for a tournament, or whether it's kind of like John said, sometimes we're focusing on something specific that we're trying to improve. Maybe we're trying to improve a certain matchup with a deck, or practice different things. Seth, why don't you go ahead and talk about your experience this week?
Sure. Well, I've been preparing for the Mythic Invitational. Unfortunately, sorry guys, I know you didn't get the invite, but I did.
Hey, so I could have tried. I just,
you know,
time is a thing.
I'm just kidding. Of course. But no, I'm super excited for it. It's a unique event. It's an exclusive tournament. It's going to be I guess the highest EV tournament that I've ever played in, right? $1 million and only 64 players, I think it is. So I've been playing best of one. Like, best of one is new to me still. I consider it new, and like, I had my reservations. Like, it was like, it's been like this quiet thing in the room, and I'm hoping that, you know, in the future we can just have a podcast topic where I can just, you know, fully rant on the subject of best of one, because I'm enjoying it.
We're going next week.
Yeah, next week. So stick around for that if you want to play on MTG Arena. I gave it a shot, right? Because I've now played probably over 1,000 games of best of one, right? So I've now 1,000
games or 1,000 matches.
Whatever you want to say. It's one game per match. So you, right. I get the joke.
It's there. A 2-for-1, John. Yeah. Ones are great.
But yeah, looking forward to that conversation next week. That's what I've been occupying my time with. So
hey, yeah. I have a question about best of one. I mean, we'll cover it a little bit more in depth next week, but I've been kind of playing some the last day or so to kind of prepare for next week's podcast. And I find that that all of the decks that I'm playing against, and I'm in Diamond right now, they're really polarizing. So like, it's like Gates decks or Esper decks or Mono Red decks, or, you know, like there's not like an Esper midrange deck sitting there, or like an Esper, everything is super polarizing, which is funny because in Hearthstone, things tend to go towards the middle. Like everything becomes a mishmash of midrange. Why do you think there's a difference between Magic and Hearthstone in that?
Well, I don't really play Hearthstone, so it's hard for me to compare that. What I can attest to is that midrange is much worse than best of one, because midrange decks are relying a lot on their sideboards to kind of allow them to position themselves against a control that maybe a midrange deck is playing, you know, some removal spells, right? Like, you're playing some amount of spot removal spells that may have no use at all again when you're playing against an Esper deck in best of one. So the biggest strength of midrange is their sideboards. Once you take sideboards out of the equation, it becomes much tougher for a midrange deck. And then you also have to go into the hand smoothing, which if you're playing a 3-color deck, you're also at a disadvantage because it's specifically on MTG Arena. So there's a couple reasons for that, and just you want to try to make a deck that basically has as few dead cards in every matchup as possible. So that's would be my answer.
Yeah, that's interesting. In Hearthstone, for what it's worth, they solve that problem by playing like tech cards for matchups that are worse for them. So like they'll play like a main deck Wrath that they wouldn't normally play for a specific matchup, and the decks are smaller and you draw less cards. So I guess like the games are fundamentally different, so it could just be that. But it was interesting to note. John, what about you? What have you done to train and improve Magic this week?
Well, I mean, I'm not qualified for this Invitational, so I've been focused on the formats that are relevant for me, which for the most part, you know, is Modern, because I'm going to go to GP Magic Fest Calgary. They're still called GPs, right? The actual tournament.
Anyway, yes.
Whatever. GP Calgary. Yeah. At the end of the month. And then the Pro Tour. So my plan, I played Tron at the last two events. The first one,
guys,
I won.
Sorry. It's so funny that you said, you asked about the GPs, and then you immediately said Pro Tour is the next thing.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just, yeah. It's going to take me about 3 years to get
it. It's fine. Go ahead. Sorry.
If we get a sponsor from, if we get a sponsor from Wizards of the Coast, I'll make more of an effort. Yeah, hashtag unsponsored. No, just kidding. I've been playing. So my plan after playing Tron at the last two GPs, I won the PTQ with Tron, but I did poorly in both GPs. I made day two of the second one, but then had a bad day two. But I don't think Tron was a great choice. And I decided that, you know, we didn't know if there was going to be a banning. Turns out there wasn't, which I'm actually happy about. I think my plan is to just like play Phoenix kind of as the bad guy, just figure out where its weaknesses are. I feel like that's going to be one of the best decks at the Pro Tour, the Mythic Championships. And I've been winning about 60% of my matches online, but I feel that almost every round I'm facing a matchup that they have a good plan against me. So even though it's the most popular deck, you know, we did a breakdown in Modern, or Spencer, you did that. on a previous podcast, I think it's a very attackable deck. I would be surprised if it just dominates the Mythic Championship. And there's a lot of ways you can attack it. And I've also been testing with the new Mulligan rule, which, by the way, like, forget whether or not the rule is good. I think it is a good way to test, because one of the things, like, you're not going to test enough games to just get really good data. So you want to make sure that all your games are relevant. And the new Mulligan rule kind of helps you have a very good game when one person's on 6 cards or even 5 cards. And one of the decks I was playing in testing was Dredge. And, like, Dredge with the new Mulligan rule, it's a huge leg up.
It's kind of funny because in our testing for the Pro Tour, we usually go 7-6-6-5-7. Like, we never play with fours or anything like that.
Well, I always just did 7 and then just 6s until you keep. But, I mean, even then, like, this is a better multi-6. Like, your multi-6 is now better, which makes it closer. And you can also see decks functioning on 5, which otherwise you couldn't really, at least reliably. So, I don't know. I think it is going to be a significant effect on which decks are good in Modern. But I think... I mean, I don't know if that's good or bad. Like, the degenerate decks like Dredge and Tron, I mean, Tron's going to have their turn 3 Tron a lot more on their Mulligan, which is important because they Mulligan a lot. Key sideboard cards. We'll see how it plays out, but, like, I've been testing for that and also just finding out where Phoenix is weak. That's what I've been working on.
How does it feel to have essentially, maybe this is giving you a little bit too much credit, but you kind of broke the format. Like, you were one of the first people behind this deck originally, right? And you played it at a Grand Prix like 3 months ago or whatever. Maybe it wasn't that long ago, but, and like, I think you finished 9th, and that was when it was like a pretty new deck. So, like, I'm guessing it feel like if I was in your position, like, you were playing it before people really like caught on to it, and then like everyone now is playing it. So I don't know. How does that feel?
Well, I mean, it's not like it's sort of validating in the fact that I gravitated to it very quickly and realized how good it was. I don't think the version I was playing very early on was necessarily the best version. And I certainly didn't build the archetype. Like, I started with a 5-0 list and went from there. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of weird because, like, I played it in 2 GPs kind of before it became popular. First one, I didn't do great, but that was, I felt like I got pretty unlucky to not do well in that tournament. And the second one, I finished 9th. There was a Phoenix deck in the top 8, but then since then I haven't played it because the deck has weaknesses, and I just kept seeing, okay, I can't really beat that deck. This deck's very difficult. Everyone's playing Eidolon. White's a nightmare matchup. Dread Creeping Chill is a problem. But then it's doing better and better. So I don't know. Like, I felt like I should just play it in Calgary, but, like, I've been testing online, and usually when I'm doing well with the deck online, I'm going 4-1 in most of my leagues. And with this deck, I'm going 3-2 in most of my leagues. So I don't know. It's an interesting experience, I guess.
Do you think that Creeping Chill being good against the deck is the reason that Dredge is uptick so much in popularity?
Well, I think there was a cycle where, you know, the first thing that happened was people started to play Burn to beat Phoenix because of Eidolon. And then Creeping Chill is really good against both Burn and Phoenix.
Sure.
So that pushed it. And also just Dredge is kind of a good deck. But it can be kept in check as well. So, I think...
You made the point that Dredge is, like, getting better with the new Mulligan rule. But I'm curious if it actually gets worse. Not because the deck itself gets worse, but because ley lines are just completely overpowered now. Like, black ley line, you can just immediately always have it in play against Dredge.
I've thought about that with Volokit too, because I for a long time was playing Volokit with the white ley lines in my board, and I was splashing white too so that I could even cast it. And it really sucked to have to, like, mulligan 4 ley line in Scapeshift. But when you drew it in the matchups that you drew it in, like, you couldn't lose, and they were, like, really bad matchups for you. So I wonder if, like, decks that can use Leyline to fix their bad matchups gain a lot of advantage too, in addition to what Seth is saying, in the, like, hurting other decks.
I think what you're saying is going to be true. I mean, this is just from my early testing. I think it's going to be true that, like, your post-cyborg games get worse. but I still don't think it's going to be correct for people to mulligan, you know, functional hands to try to find ley line. What is going to happen is that their mulligans will find ley line more often naturally, which is going to hurt your win percentage. But I mean, I wasn't really thinking that Dredge is going to be a better deck. Just the experience of mulliganing to six or five with Dredge kind of feels like, just feels so much better because, like, okay, here's seven cards. I have two land, a Dredger, a Faithless Looting. Oh, and it's Creeping Chill. And, you know, that I'm just going to put on the bottom of my deck anyway. Like,
yeah, that makes sense.
But yeah, no, what you're saying is true. And also, like, there's going to be other effects. Like, you know, Thoughtseize decks might get better as people. Mulliganing becomes more attractive. So people go to lower cards and then you take their one key card and now they don't have a functional hand. So there's going to be all sorts of effects. It's going to be interesting.
And I think the deck with the most buzz right now over the new mulligan rule is Tron, you know, so, and that's a deck you've had experience with, and just finding the Tron definitely, like, Tron is a deck that similar to Dredge also mulligans a lot, and yeah,
it should be. Yeah, but actually at the last GP I played, so the last three rounds I was X2, I had three games where I mulled to five in a row, where I was playing for my day two life and I won them all, including a mirror where I went on five cards, turn three, four, five Karns, and
okay,
yeah, like I five times in the last three rounds, I multiplied five, and I won four of those games. It's just a deck that like can function on a low number of cards if it has turn three Tron, and your multi five is now going to see seven cards, and with seven card hand, I don't know the percentages, I haven't calculated, but it's, you have a pretty high chance of hitting turn three Tron if you see seven cards, so. And it doesn't matter if you have a Wurmcoil and a Karn, as long as you have one threat, you'll draw into more. It's just getting there on turn three that's important.
Awesome. So for me this week, I've been playing so much of like the best decks for hashtag quest for 10 that I really just wanted to play some more interesting stuff. And one of the
quest things... for 20? No quest.
No. Okay. I've done every tier one deck in standard, so now I gotta have some fun. And the videos are coming on the last two, so you know, stay tuned for those. But I tried a list that Raphael Levy had posted. It's like Mono Red Phoenix, but Splashing Black for Duress, Theater of Horrors. Have you seen this deck, Seth?
I did. I was actually streaming last night, and I raided Raphael Levy.
Oh, so okay.
I went to his stream, and I saw him playing this deck, yeah.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. The deck's really... It's funny. You get flooded a lot. Like, I probably got flooded 60% of my games with the deck, and I played, like, you can play games fast. So I, like, played a lot of matches. And I think that's just, like, the part of playing, like, six cantrips that are just cantrips, right? Like, naturally, you flood out more. If your opponent has, like, one answer to something, it can often cause that feeling. But one of the things that was nice was playing something completely different than anything that I play. Like, I would never play an Electrostatofield deck. Like, that's just not a thing that I would typically do. And it's interesting to be learning different play patterns. Like, holding your cantrips for the right time in this deck is really important for your Phoenixes, because you only have those red ones, and you know, it's been cool. I think that oftentimes as Magic players, people identify as something, right? Whether like this aggro mage, or they're this control mage, or this mid-range mage, or this combo mage. And it's just nice to kind of get out of your comfort zone a little bit and learn other archetypes that are completely different from what you would normally play. And that's kind of what I got to do the last 2 days. Have either of you had experience playing decks like this, by the way?
Well, I haven't actually seen his list, so...
But you played the Mono Red Phoenix deck, right? In Modern?
Oh, yeah, that deck was... I really liked playing that deck. I was testing that a lot before I played Blue-Red, and I was just crushing everyone, but I was really worried about, you know, Rest in Peace, because it's much more vulnerable to that.
Did you find that there were more games where you sputtered out when your cantrips were... I guess in that deck, your cantrips are, like, the same.
It's very similar. It's a very similar deck to, like, an Is It Arclight deck, or a... I was playing a red... a blue-red brew on my stream, which was like a Phoenix variant. Mm-hmm. But well, yeah, basically any deck with a lot of like card draw, but like you still have to play your land. You have to play a number of lands to just be able to cast your things in the first place. But yeah, the more cantrips you put in your deck.
Yeah. it definitely felt like I was flooding out. Then there was not like flood insurance in the deck either, right? Like there's not like these mana sinks for you to be doing with it. So it was interesting to, because of that, you have to maximize your turns in different ways. You know, use your mana correctly, make sure that you're sequencing in different ways than you would expect to. Like, you're never just cantripping on turn one to cantrip in this deck. That's just not a thing that you would do, because you need to save those for your electrostatic fields and for your phoenixes to get back and for your steamkins. So that was just like a really interesting learning moment for me the last couple days. Cool.
Yeah, I mean the modern version has like Faithless Looting to sort of get as flood insurance. Like you can just flash that back.
Yeah.
But I did find that with the Arc Lake Phoenix is like you need to save your cantrips because like it's not, you know, if your hand's full, you know, if you have a bunch of lava spikes in your hand, it's not always trivial to cast three spells because they don't replace themselves. So like it's.
So it's.
You're saying Tormenting Voice isn't as good as Faithless Looting. That's interesting.
it's
close.
It's funny though, because I didn't think that would be a similarity in the blue red decks, and I played a bit of the blue red Phoenix deck in Standard, and I don't know that I had the same feeling.
I don't have it with the blue red deck because the cantrips are so good at finding more spells.
Yeah.
They're not just like draw one. Like Thoughtscour is the only one that's just draw one. But yeah, and also just the fact that it has Crackling Drake at the top of the curve, a card which I'm not even sure belongs in the deck, but it's just like. You're going to always be drawing lands to something.
Sure.
It's kind of nice.
All right. Well, that is going to do it this week for that segment. Let's talk about our main segment this week. We're going to do training grounds on green, red aggro, gruel aggro, as we call it. And I tweeted today that we're doing the best guild today, guys. This is my homie right here. The gruel. They're my people.
It was a patron vote though, right? You didn't select it.
I didn't select it.
So we're doing it. I thought we were doing a. Oh wait, so we're doing Azorius this week, not Gruul.
Oh Seth, you gotta read the notes, man.
Or Dimir, I should say Dimir.
Dimir.
I'm a Dimir man now. I used to be all about the blue white, but I should say Dimir. I guess we'll just talk about my deck then again.
So we kind of actually mentioned the. I think a lot of people's starting point for this deck, last week, the week before, the Timothy Wu deck, and you know, I think we've all had some experience with Gruul. Seth, you actually talked to Tim Wu about his deck a little bit. Why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, so I was on the same plane, or supposed to be on the same plane, coming back from the Mythic Championship with Tim, and. Yeah, I talked with him about the deck. I've always been impressed with him as a player. He's an aggressive player. He's one of those guys that I know is going to show up with an aggressive deck. He's going to have a unique take on most of the decks that he's playing. And this time around, he was playing the Gruul deck, which if we flash back a month or 2 months, like even at the start of Ravnica Allegiance, Gruul just wasn't a thing. But now, like it is, it's relatively new. Tim's innovation, which I think was great technology, especially for the Mythic Championship, where there was a lot of mono blue, were the four, not even two, but four copies of Kral Harpooner into the main deck, which gives you, I mean, it's insane if the mono blue player just starts on a one mana, 1/1 flyer, which is, there's, you know, eight of them in the deck, and then you just immediately kill it. You 2-for-1 your opponent, and it's still a good two drop. Even against other decks like 2-mana, 3-power guy, which also has upside, like just be in random situations. So that was one of the biggest innovations. And I think you all may have been playing with the Gruul deck as well and maybe noticed they're like, it was a really good deck. I think he went like, was it 7-3 or 8-2? It was
like 8-2.
He went 8-2, yeah.
Yeah, he went 8-2, so I knew he did well with it. And even there, and like we can look at the deck and we can start to nitpick and look at things like the mana base Spencer, which I know caught your eye when you were playing with it.
Yeah, so I do want to get into the mana base. I want to jump piggyback on something you said though. So one of the other things that was so powerful about Kral Harpooner in the mono blue matchup, for what it's worth, I noticed was not only does it come down and kill a one drop, it also Stonewall's the next one drop that they would play with a Curious Obsession. They can't actually attack into it with a Curious Obsession, which actually like basically eliminates cards from their hand for a couple of turns, which also is really powerful. So that was something I noticed in testing specifically. But I think that one of the first things that we kind of all saw was the three forests in the deck in the Goblin Chain Whirlers. So, John, we both know that there was it a top eight of a Grand Prix before the Pro Tour that had the Gruul deck, or was it?
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess the first innovation, like, Gruul was, well, first of all, the cards in the new set, like, Gruul Spellbreaker is a really attractive card. People wanted to try it. There's a lot of hype about the Gruul cards in the new set. So, but most of the original versions, they were either playing like Llanowar Elf or like going almost mono red playing Chain Whirler. But then Shouta Takao top aided the Grand Prix the week before the Pro Tour with four unclaimed territories. And almost all the creatures in the deck happened to be warriors. So,
yeah,
like that was kind of the first real innovation that maybe this deck can be something more than what it looks like.
Yeah, and if you think about it, if you just take out those goblins and put in those crawl harpooners, the decks are very similar. Except now I have unclaimed territory instead of forest.
Yeah, harpooners are warrior as well. So they've Gruul Spellbreaker, Growth Chamber Guardian, Harpooner, Chain Whirler, even Pelt Collector. If they decide to run that, those are all warriors.
Yeah.
Which is, you know.
Yeah. So I actually have been running Pelt Collector, and one of the things that I cut for it. I'd love your guys' opinion on this. I talked to like a bunch of people about this. They all agree with me, but you guys have both played the deck, so I'd love to hear your thoughts. I actually cut the fourth Growth Chamber Guardian from the deck for one of them, because I found that while Mana Sinks are really good and really needed in the deck, you weren't ever winning games with the fourth one, and usually you were just doing it to try and dig yourself out of a game that you were never going to win anyway, and drawing the second one was so bad that I thought it was a really reasonable cut, and I've really liked it.
Well, okay, so I don't really agree with that. So first of all, I had Pelt Collectors and Growth Chamber Guardian in one of the first versions I was playing. So, like, I don't think it's, you necessarily have to go that route. But the reason I think the fourth is important, I'd say mainly the mirror. Like, filling the board with four fours, like, I often go through all four of them.
I agree with John. I've actually won games with the fourth one before, so it's come up for me. Yeah. Sometimes, the deck sucks when it misses its third land, which happens, whatever, some percentage of the games, and then but then those aren't games you're gonna win anyways. But when you play the Growth Chamber on two, like if I have another one in my hand, like sometimes they just kill it.
Yeah, it's like a lightning rod. Like they want to kill your first one.
That's very true, and that does entice you to play more if they're just gonna snap it off on that one. So that's good feedback. Maybe I'll try finding a cut for the fourth one again. I haven't really missed it, but yeah. So for me, outside of that, kind of to what John alluded to, once I had added the unclaimed territories to the deck, I kind of like just did a quick search for warriors in standard, in green and red, in gather and. Yeah, Pelt Collector was the one that I was like, okay, well, this is pretty sweet. But Seth, I think we were both actually been playing Planeswalkers in the deck too.
Yeah. Well, it's funny when you're talking about the unclaimed territories, because we all thought about it, right? When we were like I saw the deck list and I was like, he went 8-2 with this, and there's three forests and four chamberlers. And I was in the car with Tim. I happened to be with him right after the Mythi Championship, and I was like, why did you do this? And he obviously thought it was 100% correct what he was doing, and he, which, you know, more power to him. But he said his reasoning was that mono red played 21 mountains and four chain whirlers, and he was comparing it to mono red, and I was like, oh god, like we have to go down this path, like they're just two different decks, like it just doesn't make sense. It's not good logic. Mono red has cards like Light Up the Stage that allow them to draw additional cards, so it's not actually 21 lands. And then, like, sometimes you're just going to have draws where you only have three lands. right? And you need to play your Chain Whirler. And it's happened multiple times. I've been playing online. My opponent has Mountain Mounted Forest in play, and I know that they have Chain Whirlers stuck in their hands. I think that the Unclaimed Territories are also have their issues, right? Like, we're naming Goblin, or we're naming Warrior. Sometimes we're naming Phoenix, like, because we need to cast our Phoenixes also.
You don't ever have to do that, right? Like, unless you're playing
the three forest version.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But, like, you wouldn't be doing that both. So, yeah, you probably aren't naming Phoenix. But, yeah, so Goblin or Warrior. But anyways, yeah, sometimes it's an issue casting your... Like, if you're playing Zerte Goblin, some versions have that. Some versions have the Harpooner now.
Right.
I think Harpooner was great for... Harpooner was great for the Mythic Championship, but now, like, maybe if Mono Blue is not as popular, maybe you can mix it up. But yeah, anyways, you asked me about Planeswalkers. I think that it kind of depends on the mana base, which ones you want to play. They're kind of interchangeable. We've talked about, I think Tim primarily had them in the sideboard, but I've seen various copies of Karn, which is obviously my favorite, Domri, and Vivian Reed. So personally, knowing me, you can probably guess which one of those I have in the main deck and which ones of those I have in the sideboard.
We got two Karn lovers on this podcast. One of them likes the 4-mana Karn. One of them likes the 7-mana Karn. It's fine.
I like the 4-mana one, too.
Well, I like both.
I played that one at the previous PT at Red Black when no one else was playing that. Although Seth probably played it. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
So, just for reference, Tim had one Karn and two Vivian Reed in the sideboard.
Is anyone else hoping for a new card in what is it?
I'm trying to figure out if they'll just reprint a bunch of them or if there's like 32 new ones.
What's the new set called? War of the Sparks?
War of the Spark.
Okay. God, I'm so excited for more Karns. Please.
I will say, like, I didn't test Domri very much. But it's pretty nice with Kral Harpooner, right? Like, you just
one-shot
them.
So one of the things is once I added Pelt Collector, I realized that the Domri's in my sideboard that were there replacing the Vivian Reeds because of when you cut the forest, it's actually kind of hard to get double green. So we were playing Domri in that spot, and it was actually really, really good out of the sideboard. So I was like, all right, well, I'll just main deck this, and I can actually add another card to my sideboard, and I'm, like, really, really improving my Esper matchup, which I thought was really bad. And Domri's been really good. Being able to give any creature in your deck haste is like has been really sweet. Is an interesting way. It's like you take a turn off to play it, right? Or maybe like you play a Pelt Collector off of it or a Shock off of it or whatever. But then what happens is like you plus it. And then you like put a Goblin Chain Whirler in play and attack, and like they can't block that. Or like you get to haste out a Phoenix, or you get to haste out like these things that are, or just make something way bigger than the thing that they could have played last turn, so that they can't ever attack your Domri Raid. So that's been pretty sweet for me.
One of the coolest interactions with Domri that we haven't mentioned is with Growth Chamber Guardian. You can go ahead gets a counter, then you're searching for another one. Absurd.
That's come up a bunch of times. And like John said, its interaction with Kral Harpooner, you know, you just get a hasted out and just deal them like 8.
I will say, like, okay, so one of the cards I did test early on was Rhythm of the Wild, and that card was very disappointing. And I think so the line of play you're talking about where you like take one turn off and you play it, then all your threats are like hasted, bigger, whatever. That line of play wasn't really doing it for me. Like, you are on a very, like, especially against, like, the Esper decks with Teferi or the Nexus decks, like, taking a turn off is really costly.
I shouldn't have said that, because, like, you're either drawing cards or you're, like, putting in or you're playing it on 5 to put a 2-drop into play, right? So you're actually not taking a turn off.
I think Domri is more utility than Rhythm.
Yeah, it's situational. Like, Against a control deck, you may want to take a turn off if you're worried about Kaya's Wrath. You may want to be taking a turn off from playing creatures. But then, like if it's an aggressive, like I'm not keeping my Domri's in against mono red or whatever. Like I'm just gonna be all creatures because you can't afford it.
Yeah,
yeah. The other card that we haven't talked about yet though is Collision Colossus. That card is. Just first of all, its interaction with Gruul Spellbreaker, which I think we all think is one of if not the best cards in the deck. Being able to, Colossus your guy, for free basically because it has Hexproof during your turn was really good for me.
Yeah, it's just a flexible card. There's a lot of random flyers. I know from experience playing a deck with 3 copies of Doom Whisper and 4 copies of Thief of Sanity in the main that there's random flyers that you are just killing down. And then other times it's just, all right, 2 mana, like 4 damage most of the time.
Yeah, like just not having to worry about like Lyra, for example.
Yeah.
Is just super nice. Like the card's really good. And it also, even in like the creature mirror, like if you're playing a mirror, like it's kind of like a Gore Clan Rampager. Like you just, the +4/+2 trample is like a real card. It's something, an effect that you want. Yeah, you could just kill people out of nowhere. The card really impressed me. And it also sort of trivializes the mono blue. Like that's the one thing, like you guys are really high on Kral Harpooner. My take on it was slightly different. I was playing without the Kral Harpooners and I was still crushing mono blue. I think this sure. deck, like the just red green deck is just very good against mono blue.
Yeah, I mean, I moved 2 Kral Harpooners to the sideboard for like, that's how good the matchup felt.
Like it's, it's a warrior, which I like, and it has some other applications. Certainly if you're playing Domri, it's better and stuff like that. But I mean, for me, like, I don't think you need that to push the mono blue matchup in your favor. Like it's already in your favor. Obviously it's going to help.
You know what we need to do to innovate ourselves is to add Galtas to the deck. That way we keep in the 4 Harpooners.
I tried that.
Oh god, like... Harpooner into Galta is ridiculous.
Yeah, like, yeah. And in the mirrors, because everyone's playing Gruul now, we just play a Galta and we're just like, okay, beat this now.
I actually thought about that. We can get to the 5 drops if you guys want, because that actually like kind of ties
is Galta is if Galta's a warrior, I'm sold. I know it's not.
It's not, and it's double green. But so when I was building, I tried an elf version once I had Domri 2 that didn't have the Chain Whirlers. And when I was building that version, I was like, okay, well, like, what if I played, like, Regisaur Alpha and Galta in this deck instead of some of the stuff that I'm playing? And I felt like I didn't have enough room for that stuff in addition to, like, Growth Chamber Guardian and Gruul Spellbreaker and Rekindling Phoenix.
My feeling about that is, and I also did try some Galta decks. I guess what we were saying earlier in the podcast, when the Patreon question, which was like, trying to attack the pillars of the format. When you're going bigger with a mid-range deck, like you're sort of playing into the hands of the Nexus of Fate decks. They right. want you to play yes. slow creatures. You're like playing into the Teferi control decks that want to find like a single counterspell to counter your 5-drop or your 6-drop.
Right.
And you're also playing to the hands of the aggro decks that are trying to kill you on turn 5.
Right.
Yes, it's going to be good in the mirror. Yes, it's going to be good probably against Sultai. But like, there's a lot of areas where it's going to be weak.
Yeah.
Just that entire strategy.
So for me, I didn't even get to the playing the games. I like looked at the cards and I was like, I don't think these are better than the things that I'm doing. Probably a lot because I was so worried about things like Esper control. For one, and it's just like this doesn't help my bad matchups in the Simic Nexus deck and the Esper deck. So for me, the 5-drop that I went to was just the same one that Tim ended up on, which is the Scargan Hellkite. I've had lots of games where Scargan Hellkite was, one of the best cards in my deck, which was funny because I like tried I tried Gruul decks when the set first came out, and I didn't like Scargan Hellkite. I thought it was bad.
You know what's funny about those 2 5-drops? Like, sort of talking about Scargan Hellkite and Siege Gang Commander. I've played with both, and with both, I'm winning games that I would lose with the other card.
Yes.
Which is sad because the card I really want to play is Biogenic Ooze, and that's just I was losing all the games with that card. But like, I was playing Mono White for the Pro Tour, right? Siege Gang Commander is a nightmare. Scargan Hellkite you can beat. That's the way I felt. But then, you tap out for like a Planeswalker and they play Hellkite, you're like, oh, that's really bad for me, right? So I don't know.
Yeah, I think that the thing about Gruul is known for having the best creatures, right? So like we have all of these really good creatures at each point in our curve. And so it's really just like we're unfortunately put in this position where we have to compare Zerte Goblin and Kral Harpooner. And they're so similar and they're like, it's so hard to actually discern which one's going to be better. unless we're looking at matchups similar
there's
to
also like Direfleet Daredevil, which is a two drop in the deck, right?
Yeah, Direfleet Daredevil, that's another two drop. Like, there's
a
lot
that,
of options.
I call that extra lava coils.
Just throw it out. I don't think it's correct, but I mean, I was looking at the list of warriors and Throne Lieutenant's a warrior. That's an interesting card.
I tried that one too. That card is. That card. Go finish with your thought, Seth, and I'll actually get to Throne Lieutenant.
Yeah. Anyways, I was just going to say that I could see a version with Llanowar Elves. Like, you don't have to play Chain Whirler if you don't. It's a metagame choice, but Chain Whirler is a super powerful card. You're making some sacrifices. Like we mentioned, playing on Clean Territories does make your sideboard options a little bit worse. Like, your Cinder Vines, maybe, like, you don't have quite as many actual green sources now to cast a turn two Cinder Vines, which is one of your best cards against those non-creature matchups. And anyways, my favorite creature in the deck is Gruul Spellbreaker. Love that card. Part of that is from playing a bunch of best of one, and I'm playing mono red, and, like, they just play a 3-mana 4/4, and I just scoop up my cards because I don't have lava coils in my deck. But, yeah, so I've been impressed with the Spellbreaker in general. And the 5-drop slot between the Skargon Hellkite and the Siege Gang is, like, I've been going to Hellkites because I've seen more Hellkites than Siege Gangs now, even though, like, a month ago I saw more Siege Gangs. So it's just, like, I'm just, like, whatever.
I think it's possible that, like, the correct version for your metagame might be, like, 2-1. Like, I don't think it's necessarily one being strictly better than the other.
That's a really good point. I know that the difference is, though, like, I know that Jerry Thompson is the was playing a lot with this deck, and I think his list was, like, really, really close to Tim's, except had the
Unclaimed Territories.
It did have those, but it also had the Goblin.
What do you guys think about the removal suite? Because we've got a couple options there if we're playing. So Collision Colossus, we all agree, I think, is just in, right?
Yeah.
That's just an automatic. But then there's also other cards, like, you could play Shock, you could play Lightning Strike, I think is where Tim went.
Yeah.
Yeah, Tim had 4 Lightning Strike, with the main reason being killing the Wild Growth Walker.
Yep. Yeah, that
makes a lot of sense.
So for me, I've been playing 3 Lava Coil, 2 Thrash Threat, 2 Shock, 2 Collision Colossus. I found that my Lightning Strikes were not as good as I wanted them to be. I have not had problems with Soul Tie, so that hasn't come up for me as much. It's pretty easy to actually attack with the Chain Whirler into that card, and you're attacking most of the time anyway. But yeah, I've that's what I've been doing.
You haven't been having problems with Soul Tie matchup. Are you talking best of one or best of three? Because I think Soul Tie is quite difficult.
Best of three. Okay. That matchup's been fine for me.
All right, let's play a grudge match. We'll play for
let's go right here. Let's do it. I'll stream it.
Definitely take the Salt Tide deck.
I'll stream it right now. Let's go. I'll just play versus the best player in the world. That will clearly say if the matchup is good or bad.
So when you first brought up the topic of a deep dive, like, I was thinking, like, in my head, like, what's a deep dive for me? And, like, a deep dive for me is when I'm like, all right, I want to investigate whether this is a deck I want to play. It's not like, sure, I'm not brewing it from scratch. So I'm like, I'm going to take red green. And the first thing I do is, like, I go through the metagame and I'm like, okay, well, what do I expect these matchups to play out? And, you know, is this deck, do I think this deck's well positioned? And then what matchups do I need to investigate to see if, like, I can shore up that matchup or if it's actually as good or as bad as I thought? And, like, my first thought of red green was, like, I think I'm going to have trouble with the mid-range decks. I'm going to have trouble with the Nexus decks, like, over the top, because I'm not as fast as, like, mono-white or mono-red. I'm going to be very good against mono-blue. Probably, I think I'm going to be very good against mono-red, because, like, Gruul Spellbreaker, like,
yeah,
I just make it a 4-4.
Like,
how do they ever attack me? I was also worried about Esper. Even though it's got a lot of cards that are good against Esper, like, Teferi is just such a powerful card, and this deck gives them time to develop and to Wrath, and to, like, you have your card advantage engines, you have Growth Chamber Guardian. Like, this, that was a matchup I was very unsure about, because the cards are good against Esper, but Esper has a lot of tools that you often don't see in a standard control deck. I was worried about Salt Tide. Like, I think like the Wild Growth Walker plan is just quite good if it's not answered. Find Finality is great against all these X4s you're playing. Yeah, and they have like heart advantage, big creatures.
You know, we're just gonna get a tweet that asks Seth to crush my soul now. So I'm really glad we said it on the podcast. I actually have found like a lot of our cards to be good in that matchup for what it's worth. Like you get a play to the board and it's like pretty good. So one of the things that did happen though, for it, to John's point, is actually when I played the elf version, I wasn't good against Sultai because Chainwheeler was surprisingly good in that matchup. You know, being able to pick off an elf that would get them to Vivian Reed faster or, deal with a couple of things, like a couple of explore creatures in play that weren't that good. Like that gave me a lot of percentage points that I didn't expect. However, I am playing more Lava Coils and like Thrash Threats, so like I still don't have a problem with Wild Growth Walker.
Wild Growth Walker.
Yeah. But I don't know. This Chainwaller has been really good in that matchup for me, which I did not expect. Any thoughts on that one, Seth, before we move on from that?
Well, I'm still, I think that it's going to be a metagame call. Like there's not like, it's another choice that you have to make. My version is not just, I don't like just playing four of one removal spell. I prefer diversifying in some way.
Sure.
And then I think Lava Coil is a pretty important card against some of the Drake decks, against some of the...
Yeah, Lightning Strike was just not that great for me.
Yeah.
My experience was also, like, Lava Coil, to me, was the one I wanted the most. I would play at least three. Like, there's cards in the format that you have this sinking feeling when they play them and you don't have an answer. Like, Thief of Sanity, Hostage Taker are two of them. Rekindling Phoenix is the card in this deck that it's like, sometimes you play that card and your opponent doesn't have an answer and the game's over. And it also is true if you're playing against a Phoenix deck and if you've used your Lava Coil on something earlier on, like a Chain Whirler or a Gruul Spellbreaker, and they play a Phoenix, you're like, oh, you know, I can't actually beat that with like Lightning Strikes or Collision Colossus. Like I need to find another Lava Coil.
The other thing about the Lava Coils, also they're great in the mirror. Besides that, I felt like it was the most important removal spell that I wanted to have access between my main deck and sideboard. So if you're not putting them in the main deck, you're putting them in your sideboard. And by putting them in the main deck, you make more room in your sideboard. So yep. That's just another thing that I've been kind of preaching about sideboard stuff, and that's kind of led me to that decision.
Yeah, I think that's why I made a lot of changes to the deck was to... I felt like you had such good matchups that you could sacrifice on that you had room to innovate to improve stuff by moving things that would typically be in your sideboard to your main deck in this deck.
I don't know what you talked about in your academy lessons, but like one of the things I do when I'm sideboarding or building a sideboard is like I won't really think of it as 60 and 50, and I'll think of it as like these are the 66 cards that are going to be in my list no matter what. And then I have like a 9-card sideboard. And then I just figure out like from those 66, you know, how many go out and how many go in. So like that's exactly true for what you're saying here with Lava Coil. Like my red green list has 4 Lava Coil. I don't know if they're main or side, but they're all there. Right. So
I think that's fair. That's true for me too. Can we talk about kind of 2 sideboard cards before we say goodbye? One of them, we kind of mentioned it, but Cinder Vines has been really, really, really important to me in the Nexus matchup.
I think it's your most important sideboard card. It is. I would just play 4. Like it's why I don't necessarily know the number of unclaimed territories. Like I think I'm on 2 territories because and you need some. Like right now, my version has Gruul Guildgate in it, which I know it's kind of awkward and
how many? Base.
Right now I've got 2, which is
that's what Tim has.
I've seen 1 and 2, or whatever. Same thing as the Timber or whatever. Timber. There's another land that is essentially a
Timber Grove or something.
Timber Grove, something like that. So I've got 2 because I just want to have decent mana, and I've been once again I've been playing like the deck that I play the most with right now is Dimir, and Cinder Vines I know is insane against me. It's really good against me. So it's good against any, it's really, it's insane against any deck that has mostly non-creature spells. like is even better, like against a Nexus deck or against a whatever Reclamation control, what have you, that it's super, super annoying. And it's how you win those matchups. So
yeah,
it's definitely a four of.
That's a card that I like when I saw it, I was like, all right, this can't be like, it can't be that good. And then I cast the first time I cast it against Simic Nexus, which is probably its best matchup. I was like, oh, they actually just can't be this card. Like,
yeah, well, they literally have to like bounce it with something that with like, a blink of an eye, yeah, and then like combo off. It's not that easy for them.
They can definitely like the Simic Nexus deck. They can definitely beat that card. Like, it's very good against them, but I mean, they're going to cast a Krasis at some point, right?
That was like, absolutely hyperbole. Yeah, that was absolutely hyperbole on my part. But I do think that like I have a positive win percentage against that deck and a very negative game one win percentage against that deck.
Yeah, I think the sideboard of it's a very good sideboard for a red green aggro deck.
Yeah.
Right.
The last card I want to talk about, which I only have one in my sideboard right now, is actually Status Statute. And it was funny, right when Mason also got Mythic with this deck and posted it, and somebody was like, what is the Status Statue for? And he's like memeing people, and I'm like, actually, I've won like so many games with this card, way more than I expected. I expected zero, like it'll come up sometimes, but it actually is really, really good. It has been for me. Like I kept the one because it, you know, the meme works.
Yeah, like I haven't actually played with it. I've played against it a lot, and it's very good in the mirror, and it's very good against mono white, which are the two decks I've been playing basically.
Yeah.
Because they like both decks, there's going to be a creature stall, right? You're going to play all your 4/4s. Both players can get all their Growth Chamber Guardians. The white deck's going to like flood it with like Venerated Loxodons and Benelish Marshals, but they're not going to be able to attack because your creatures are bigger, and they're going to be attacking you for like three in the air and just trying to buy time. And then you play Phoenix and it's a standoff, and at some point you draw a Chain Whirler Status and like, okay, good game. Like you can't come back from that. So it's been pretty devastating against me. So like, it's probably good in the deck.
Yeah. It's a super powerful effect.
Yeah. I guess we should say what it's doing, by the way, because I don't think I did.
Yeah. Okay. So it's the first half of the card Status, which is giving +1/+1 and death touch to your creature. So you play a Goblin Chain Whirler, give it death touch, and then it kills everything.
Yeah, so the trigger goes on the stack, the one to everything, and then in response to that, you use your pump spell with Death Touch, and then everything goes away. Even though we can't actually make use of the other part of it because we don't have black mana in this particular deck. There are some Jund Death Whirler decks that have the Status Statues just in the main deck, like because the removal spell is actually just a...
It's just fine. It destroys artifact, just enchantment, and creature, right, or something?
Yeah, so it's just a reasonable card. That's a different variation of the deck.
But I will say, though, that if you're looking at playing that as well as Collision Colossus like and Cinder Vines, you actually have some green requirements, so you really need to take the mana base into consideration before you just shove four and claim territories in the deck.
But so any final thoughts from you guys before we say goodbye this week? This is the deck that I've been playing the literal most since the Pro Tour or the Mythic Championship, and I've really been enjoying it.
I have a lot of fun with the deck. I don't feel it's... So we've talked a lot about like what's good about the deck, right? I actually don't feel that the deck is very good right now, but that's maybe more like what's good in the metagame. Like I feel like you're good, Matt. If there's a lot of mono blue, this is a great deck, but you rely a lot on Cinder Vines, and specifically a turn two Cinder Vines for your Esper deck, your Nexus matchups, your Reclamation matchups. I feel like maybe Sultai's close, but like I feel like Sultai's favored.
Yeah.
So it's an uphill battle, I feel, to play a mid-range deck right now that's not Sultai.
Sure.
But you do smash mono blue. And that's worth quite a bit.
And mono red for what it's worth. I think you're quite good against that deck.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I don't know. I haven't tested it. But I think a lot of the decks I've been playing in standard have been good against mono red in best of three. So I didn't expect mono red much at the Pro Tour. I don't really know if it's becoming more popular now, but yeah, I think you're good there.
I mean, I enjoyed this episode. We did a deep dive, right? We asked the patrons what deck they wanted to choose, and this is the deck that they chose. Like, is this the best deck in Standard? No, it's not the best deck in Standard.
Yeah, I don't think so.
But I think that it's a top 10 deck. It's a very, very reasonable deck, I think. And
yeah, it's certainly competitive. And yeah, if I was playing like a Standard tournament for fun this weekend, I'd probably bring this because this is the kind of deck I want to play.
Like this might be better than my Dimir deck, right? Like it honestly might be better than Dimir. I'm still going to play Dimir, like, because that's what I want to play. There's going to be people that want to play Gruul and they want, like, I don't think that there's no matchup like that is, like, Tim went 8-2 with it, and we're already critiquing the list, and like I think we're updating it, you know, and making good changes. So like there's something to this deck. The Sultai matchup is something that is up in the air. I think we have some disputing viewpoints there that we'll have to settle. But in general, I just enjoyed doing a deep dive on a deck and kind of, you know.
I think also people wanted to hear a deep dive on a deck that's not...
That's no not Sultai.
Yeah, well, it's not like the number one deck. Like, it's like, okay, we can look at all the tournament results to see how you build Esper. You know, there's lots of them.
Sure.
So,
yeah. I mean, you can go to MTG Goldfish or whatever, and you can look at the percentages and just see what the number one, two, and whatever decks are. But that's not what we're doing here, you know?
Yeah. Well, Gruul isn't like I think Gruul was like number five. It's not like it's
it's
a huge part of that is the amount of streaming that people are doing with it. Like, I think that one of the days, every single MPL, somebody text me, they're like, every single MPL member streaming right now is streaming Gruul. I was like, well.
And I will say from personal experience that it has been beating mono red, at least in best of one. So
yeah,
it's number six. I just checked on Goldfish.
Yeah,
so.
I was doing the same thing. Yeah, that's it's. Oh, look at that, Domaries in that one.
There's also things you can do with the deck, like if there's a lot of reclamation and a lot of control in your metagame, you can play Cindervine's main deck. I mean, it's going to worsen your aggro matchups, but those are generally your good matchups, so maybe that's okay. It's a little weird on the mana base, but
I might try cutting that single mountain, like going down to 9 mountain in the forest, because I actually have been having a little bit of trouble casting my Cinder Vines. So
I do like the Pell Collectors. I had those in my version as well, and that was another way to, like,
they've been really good. That has the Pell Collectors and the Domaries in the main legitimately have helped the Esper matchup to the point where, like, I don't feel like I'm just hopeless in the matchup anymore.
I also feel like it helps you put a clock on the Nexus decks. Like, when I'm playing mono white, the key thing I want to do is be able to kill them on turn 5.
Yeah.
And if I can do that, it forces them to have kind of the perfect draw. And I think that's true with this deck too. I don't know whether the turn 5 is as realistic with this deck, but like Pell Collector definitely makes it closer.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody, so much for listening this week. We really appreciate it. Don't forget to check out our sponsor, Always Games, and us over on patreon.com/ccmtg. And next week, we get to talk about Best of One.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.